huge news this week.
What?
I think I found, at this very late stage of the pandemic, a Zoom-based activity that I can actually really get behind. So you know our friend Jim Barn, the musical genius who wrote that jingle that you just heard, his dad is a wine expert. And this week, he organised a Zoom wine tasting with different wines that you can buy at the supermarket. Isn't that fun?
Why wasn't I invited?
Awkward. Sorry, it was elite friends and family only. But I was trying to remember some of the European wine facts that I learned, because there was a Hungarian wine on the list, but I can't remember anything because I was drunk.
Okay, it wasn't a very educational wine tasting then.
The one thing I remember is that there's lots of rivalry between Hungarian and Slovakian winemakers. But I can't remember why, because I was maybe four glasses in by that point. Hungarians and Slovakians, write in and let us know.
I wonder if there's a way we could do this with our Patreon supporters. It'd be difficult to source the same wine all across the world, wouldn't it?
And some people would have to be drunk at like 9 o'clock in the morning, because we do have a very nice global audience.
Yes, our listeners are all around the world. Everyone comes here to find out about what's going on in Europe. So shall I tell everyone what's coming up this week?
Do it.
Well, this week we're going to be speaking to Tim McInerney, one of the hosts of the brilliant podcast, The Irish Passport. As you have probably seen in the news, there have been weeks of unrest in Northern Ireland. Riots triggered by a very complex set of circumstances that include a topic that we have always promised not to mention, the B word, Brexit. So we are going to slightly bend that rule this week whilst talking to Tim later on. But it's a situation that is about a lot more than just Brexit. And for once, actually, we thought this Brexit-related story wasn't quite getting enough of the media oxygen that it deserved. So keep listening to hear the fascinating thoughts of Tim coming up after Good Week, Bad Week. Good Week, Bad Week. Who has had a good week, Katie?
It's been a good week for the government of the Czech Republic, or Czechia, as it's sometimes known these days. And that is because there's been a pretty high-profile court ruling from the European Court of Human Rights saying that it is not undemocratic for the Czech government to insist on children being vaccinated if they're going to attend preschool. Now, I should probably stress before we dive into this that I'm not talking about COVID vaccines here. I'm talking about the jabs that are typically given to little kids across much of Europe for diseases like tetanus, diphtheria, measles, that kind of thing. And in the Czech Republic, you are legally obliged to make sure your kids are vaccinated against 9 different diseases, including those 3 I just mentioned. And if your kid doesn't have those vaccinations, the preschool can ban them from coming in.
Is this the case in other European countries?
Yeah, it is the case in quite a lot of other countries, but to varying degrees and in different ways. So the UK, for example, doesn't legally oblige parents to vaccinate their kids, but lots of other countries do make it a legal obligation and they have different ways of enforcing it. So in the Czech Republic, your kid can be banned from preschool if they haven't got the right jabs. In Germany, it's a fine. You can be fined up to €2,500 if your kid isn't properly vaccinated. And a lot of these countries have brought in this kind of legislation because vaccination rates have been falling in recent years. If you take France, for example, vaccine skepticism has been quite a big thing during the pandemic, but it was a problem way before the pandemic as well. And there's been a bit of a measles crisis in France over the last decade because so many parents have not been getting their kids vaccinated. A lot of it gets blamed on the rise of online misinformation about the MMR jab and this kind of discredited evidence that there's a link to autism.
Ugh.
Didn't we talk about that on the podcast before?
We did, and it makes me very angry every time.
Sorry to bring it up again. But yeah, so lots of countries have tried to use the law as a weapon against this. And there is some evidence, especially from France and Italy, that it does work. The vaccination rates in those two countries have gone up over the last couple of years since both of them have got stricter on it.
But it sounds like in the Czech Republic, this was quite a controversial move to make vaccination compulsory for little kids.
Yeah, well, from what I've been reading, you know, the vast majority of Czech parents just get their kids vaccinated. But this case was brought to the European Court of Human Rights by a group of parents who had either been fined because their kids didn't have the right jabs, or they'd actually been turned away from preschools. And these families had a variety of different reasons for refusing the vaccines. In one case, it was a kid with health problems, and his pediatrician had actually recommended that he shouldn't be vaccinated. So that really does seem quite unfair for him to be banned from nursery. But mostly these parents had refused to get their kids vaccinated on the grounds of personal beliefs. One of them, for example, was this family that were okay with most of the jabs, but they were scared about the MMR jab, despite the science. So yeah, this case ended up in the European Court of Human Rights, and the court was asked to rule on whether or not this policy, mandatory jabs for kids, whether that is a fundamental infringement of people's rights to privacy and to do what they want with their own bodies. I'm curious to hear your own take on it, actually. Like, what would you have said as a judge in this case?
Judge Dominic. Well, I've always believed that it is the responsibility of all parents to vaccinate their children in order to keep the children who can't be vaccinated for health reasons safe, like in order to create herd immunity. And
right,
yeah, that requires some solidarity. And it would be great if we lived in a society where everyone just did that. But I think we're all finding out more and more through this pandemic that we're living in at the moment that you can't always trust humans to make the best choices for other people. So yeah, I think I would rule that yes, the Czech government can do this.
Yeah, I think I have the same instinct as you do. My instinct is to be like quite hardline about it. Because as you say, like if I was the parent of a kid with an immune system problem and then they got infected with a preventable disease like measles, which is potentially fatal, like of course I'd be furious about it. I do think there are some good arguments on the other side. You cannot forget that we have this history, including here in Europe, of states forcing people to do utterly horrendous things with their bodies. From the Nazi medical experiments during the Holocaust to the chemical castration of gay people, you know, we have seen how that power can be abused by the state. So yeah, fundamentally, I feel quite uneasy about the idea of governments telling us what to do with our bodies. And there are some experts who think that this kind of policy, making injections the law, could actually strengthen anti-vax movements because it alienates the kind of parents who worry about this kind of thing. I also came across some human rights law people on Twitter saying that this court case, it's interesting because it was also potentially an infringement of kids' right to an education.
Oh.
If you're going to ban them from preschool if they don't have the jabs, which was an interesting argument to make. So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those classic cases of we have different rights and you can't protect them all at the same time. Like, yes, we have a right to privacy, but we also have the right to not be endangered by other people. I mean, personally, I think it's fair enough to say that if you're going to use a public service like a preschool, it is okay to insist on people following science and doing what's necessary to avoid hurting others. And if you don't like it, then homeschool your kids.
It's something that everyone's thinking about a lot at the moment, isn't it? As vaccinations finally make their way for COVID into Europe.
Woo.
And I know here in the Netherlands, employers aren't allowed to like forbid you from coming into work if you haven't been vaccinated.
Mm.
Is this ruling going to change that discussion at all?
Yeah, I think the short answer is no one really knows yet. But maybe there are in different countries like some policies of mandatory COVID vaccination. I don't think there's any countries as a whole that are forcing people to get the jab by law. But there are things like, you know, in Italy, it's mandatory for healthcare workers to get the COVID jab, that kind of thing. So we could end up seeing more cases like this Czech one ending up in court. And when they do end up in court, this case sets a bit of a precedent to say that enforcing vaccinations by law isn't necessarily undemocratic, even if it is kind of invasive.
Oh, it's complicated.
Like everything we talk about on this podcast. Yes. Who has had a bad week?
It's been a bad week for European vultures after scientists confirmed for the first time in Europe a death of a vulture due to the anti-inflammatory drug diclofenac.
This is going to sound really bad, but I didn't even know that we had vultures in Europe.
Oh, yeah, that is very bad, Katie. In fact, Europe has the only growing population of vultures of any region in the world.
Yeah.
You knew that Europe had diclofenac though, didn't you?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it was all across that.
Good. Diclofenac is that really strong anti-inflammatory drug that like doctors give humans if they have really bad aches and pains, but they also give it to cattle. It's become very popular for giving to cows. And the vultures aren't eating it directly, but vultures munch on cattle carcasses. And when they munch on a cattle carcass that has had diclofenac in their system, it leads to a fatal kidney condition which kills the vulture. And a single carcass that's got diclofenac in its system could be fed on by multiple vultures and could poison all of them and kill them all. So it's really a horrible chain of events. And scientists last week published a study proving for the first time in Europe that a young vulture from Spain had died from this poisoning. But the connection between diclofenac use in cattle and the death of vultures is a connection that has been known for a long time. 2 decades ago, there was a devastating mass death of vultures in South Asia. Within a few years, 99.9% of some species are thought to have died due to diclofenac. So wildlife specialists have been warning against the use of diclofenac in Europe. It's now banned in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal already. But they've been calling for it since then. Farmers, drug companies, and some European medicine regulators have argued that this poisoning wouldn't be a problem in Europe, because in Europe, carcasses are apparently disposed of differently to in South Asia. Mm. But this first death shows that there still is a risk.
So this one poor vulture died, but it doesn't seem to be on the same scale as what happened in Asia yet.
Yeah, not yet. And hopefully it isn't going to get anywhere near that scale. But conservationists are suggesting that this death could just be the tip of the iceberg. This is just the first irrefutable case that's been proven. And it's not just vultures that are poisoned by the drug. It also affects breeds of eagle, including the endangered Spanish Imperial Eagle, of which there are only thought to be around 300 pairs left.
I didn't know we had those either. My European bird knowledge is so bad.
You need to go and live in Spain, where there are loads of these birds.
Okay.
But as with most ecological disasters, like the mass deaths in East Asia, they're not only a matter to be sad about for the sake of like losing a majestic species of bird. These birds have an important function in our ecosystem. And if we look at it selfishly from a human perspective for a moment, when the vultures died in East Asia, the birds were replaced by a big growth in packs of feral dogs who would feed on the carcasses instead, increasing the risk of rabies infections in humans, as well as there being an explosion of crow instead of vultures, whose presence at the carcasses posed a risk of passing infections to poultry, domesticated birds, and even onto us humans.
Whoa, food chains. They're very complicated, aren't they?
Yeah, and we know what happens when viruses pass through animals to humans. And this is where I was like, my mind was blown in this story, because apparently vultures are referred to as nature's cleanup crew because their metabolisms are virtual dead ends for pathogens. So they're the perfect creatures to eat a nasty pathogen that could be passed on to a human and make us very sick.
What? So their stomachs just kill the bad germs?
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that great?
They're amazing. Vultures are amazing. So is this diclofenac thingy, is that legal?
Well, this is the controversial thing. In parts of Europe, it has been approved by regulators in cattle. The European Medicines Agency, they decided back in 2014 not to ban the drug in cattle, but to impose regulations on its usage and labelling to remind users of the risk to vultures. This was after the Spanish and Italian drug regulators had already approved the use of the drug, which was particularly controversial in Spain because that's the country with the biggest vulture population. In Portugal, the regulator is currently deciding on what to do. And conservationists point out that there are effective alternatives that are affordable and safe to use. So they are incredibly frustrated that diclofenac continues to be used in cattle. BirdLife International, who have been campaigning against diclofenac for years, put out a statement saying, "The evidence found in Spain sadly confirms what we have been warning about for almost a decade. Vultures are already dying from veterinary diclofenac poisoning, and this could already be affecting their population trends." Mm. So there are renewed calls now for the regulators to go back and look again at this drug and consider banning it and using the alternatives. Seems a bit like a no-brainer.
It does. And, you know, I'm not normally one of these people that is only in favour of protecting cute animals. And vultures, you don't really think of them as being very cute. But I've just been looking at pictures of them while you were talking. And they're cuter than you think. They've got these fluffy little trousers on.
Especially when they're young. And the one that died was only just over a year old.
Oh, save the vultures. Speaking of vultures, kind of, I've got a bone to pick with you.
What?
So you know how every time that we get a new Patreon supporter, we send them a nice email saying thank you? I've noticed that when you send it, you take all of my exclamation marks out. So instead of saying like, Hi, thank you for supporting the podcast. It says, hello. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast. Like, do you hate exclamation marks or something?
No, it's just when you send it, sometimes you have four successive sentences all with exclamation marks at the end of them. I mean, I know we're like relatively jolly people.
It's too much.
And maybe that is just how we speak, but it is a bit much.
Oh. Well, interestingly, in France, there is a tendency to think that people who overuse exclamation points are like a bit stupid. I got told by a colleague like not to do it so much. Maybe you're secretly French.
Maybe this is just about you.
Maybe it's me. Anyway, this week, I just want to send a big thank you with an exclamation point on the end to the three lovely new people who signed up this week to give us a few bucks a month so that we can keep making this podcast. Big thanks go to Rachel Gibbs, Marie Highland, and Mercedes Martinez.
Come along and join them. Depending on how much you pledge, you can receive a personalized voice message from Katie and me, a postcard from Amsterdam or Paris, or even one of our limited edition Angry Macron bags. Head to patreon.com, which is spelled patreon.com/Europeans podcast to find out how to sign up.
We pride ourselves on not talking too much about Brexit on this podcast because it's something that's sapped up rather a lot of oxygen over the past year. But as Dominic said, we also pride ourselves on talking about the stories that don't really get enough attention. So we are going to be breaking our own rule this week and talking about something that is Brexit adjacent, even if it's not 100% about the B word. We want to talk about Northern Ireland this week because there have been riots over the past couple of weeks in several different Northern Irish towns and cities. You might have seen these really quite disturbing images of a bus set on fire. But then again, even if you live in the UK, you might not have seen this on the news. Because even though Northern Ireland is a part of the UK, it's one of the four countries that makes up the United Kingdom, along with England, Scotland and Wales. It's not really had perhaps that much attention. I don't know if you felt like this too, Dominic.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, the first I heard about it was when my dad called me up and said, you should talk about the Brexit riots in Northern Ireland. And I was like, we don't talk about Brexit. And then I looked into it and discovered it's much more than just Brexit riots.
Yeah, but in general, I mean, the fact that there were riots, it felt like if there had been riots in a city, an English city like Manchester, there would have been rolling round-the-clock news coverage.
Yeah.
And that was kind of weird. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of coverage of Prince Philip, RIP, but also things like the George Floyd trial taking up the headlines in the UK, which, you know, obviously it's a terrible story, but this was a lot closer to home and was kind of weirdly absent. This woeful disinterest that English people often have about Northern Ireland, it is a very real and weird phenomenon. There was a poll a few years ago suggesting that about a third of Brits weren't actually sure whether Northern Ireland was part of the UK and could vote in our elections.
No.
Yeah, seriously, it's kind of mad. There's like a whole bit of the UK that English people often don't seem to be aware of as part of the same country. It's really very odd. And it's something that comes up fairly often, in fact, on the superb podcast, The Irish Passport. It is a podcast about Irish history and politics and culture. If you've been listening to The Europeans for a while now, you'll have heard one of its hosts, Naomi O'Leary, a couple of times on the show over the past couple of years. This time, though, we thought we would talk to her co-host, Tim McInerney, who is a very good friend of mine, also living in Paris. He is a lecturer in British and Irish cultural history at Paris 8 University. So we thought we would ring him up to try to unpick what has been happening in Northern Ireland with these riots over the past couple of weeks, but also try to work out what is going on with this very weird phenomenon that he calls the knowledge gap. I am very aware of the irony of us asking you, as two British people, to like Northern Ireland's plane for us, given that the Northern Ireland is part of the UK. But just to help our listeners get our heads around what's been happening over the past couple of weeks, could you give us an idea of where these riots seem to have come from? And like, what, if anything, does it have to do with Brexit?
That's a really interesting question. And I should say that also, you know, I'm not from Northern Ireland either, nor I'm not at all an authoritative voice on this. Something that I can say is that talking about this at all is politically charged in quite a fundamental way. So the riots in Northern Ireland, on the face of it, these are riots that generally seem to have come from the loyalist community. And on the face of it, this is in reaction in some degree to the sea border that has come into force as a result of Johnson's Brexit deal. Now, that's the very simplest terms that most people are working off. But the riots themselves are a lot more complicated. And politics in Northern Ireland are extremely, extremely nuanced. And there's all sorts of other factors that are feeding into this as well, which also have nothing to do with Brexit. But what seems to be happening and what seems to have been happening for the last few years is that commentators from whatever side they're on seem very eager to instrumentalize something like this happening in Northern Ireland to further a narrative that suits them. So what we've seen in the last few days are, you know, people who tend towards the Remain position in the UK saying, oh, this is all the fault of Brexit, and there are riots in Northern Ireland because of Brexit, look what you've done. And people who tend towards the Leave position in the UK have been saying, oh, this is all because of the EU. This is because the EU won't let us have the Brexit that we want and that they're forcing these conditions onto Brexit. Now, neither of those positions are completely true, but what's common to both of them is that they're kind of lazy. And what's important to that narrative is the politics of England, really. So the main thing I would say about what's going on in Northern Ireland, which is something that my co-host said very eloquently, is that I can't tell you. because that's the kind of point. Talking about it in these terms, in terms of Brexit or in terms of external politics, is the problem.
I think that's a very clear explanation of what is happening or what you can't say is or isn't happening. But would you be able to answer a question about whether you think the fact that the EU and the UK and the Northern Ireland Assembly and the Irish government are together now trying to find a way to change this Northern Irish protocol, do you think in any way that could be a solution to the current unrest? Changing this deal?
Oh, geez. I mean, maybe. But like, I think it kind of misses the point thinking about this or thinking about solutions to this in the first place. The problem of the Brexit campaign for Northern Ireland was that Northern Ireland is just extremely sensitive. It's extremely unstable. Problems like this could have just as easily arisen in the nationalist community or in a different community or among some other entirely different sector entirely. But the problem is there are grievances in Northern Ireland pre-existing and they are ready to go. So that the main objection to Brexit was that it was like lighting a tinderbox, that it was going to involve at least something like the sea border or something like the land border that was going to set off something like this, whether it was, you know, from whichever community, that could roll into a bigger snowball very, very easily, because this is a territory that has only been at peace for 20 years. And most people alive in the territory are, you know, the wounds of the conflict in Northern Ireland are extremely fresh in their minds. They are living down the road from people who have murdered members of their family, or they're living on the opposite side of a peace wall to a community that they have historically, you know, like hated often, you know, with personal hatred because of things that one has done to the other. So when you consider that people on an individual level had put so much effort for the last 20 years into quenching those grievances or into suppressing those grievances and trying to live together. That was the main objection to Brexit, right? That it was ruining all of that. It was going to throw a spanner in those works and just ignite everything again.
The Good Friday Agreement, if I understand it correctly, says that a border poll could happen. Is it likely to happen at any point in the future? And does Brexit make it more likely?
Brexit definitely makes it more likely. I don't think that's particularly contested. How much more likely, however, is a big question. There have been various polls in the last year, actually, showing that a majority of people expect it to happen in the next 10 years, I think it was, in Northern Ireland. The motivations for wanting a reunification vote are not necessarily clear. Some people may want a reunification vote sooner rather than later because they expect it would fail. And this is a question of changing demographics in Northern Ireland. Basically, since the creation of Northern Ireland in 1922, the demographics have been steadily shifting. Back in 1922, it was about 70% British identifying people in Northern Ireland or unionists, and about 30% nationalists or Irish identifying. Over the course of the 20th century, that's leveled out. So now it's more around 50-50 if you only include those two categories. But it also includes a third category now, which is people who identify neither as British nor Irish, but as Northern Irish. So identity is shifting very, very, very quickly. And unionists objected to the Good Friday Agreement because of those changing demographics, because they saw that if a vote was allowed to happen at any point, it was just a question of time until Irish identifying nationalists were the majority in Northern Ireland, and that then a vote would be carried easily. But when they were worried about that back in 1998, they were expecting a vote to be happening like in 2050. like 2060, you know, one or two generations to have passed first. So what Brexit has done is it's accelerated that. You know, the border poll was never really designed to happen this soon, because if it happened today, for instance, you would be dealing with this really problematic 50-50 split with another kind of, I think it's 25% of people who don't even identify as British or Irish at all. So it would almost definitely cause conflict if it happened now. That doesn't mean that people don't want it to happen, but it makes it into a very different prospect than it used to be before the Brexit campaign.
And that actually brings me to something that you talked about on the podcast recently, this really interesting idea. You talked about this idea of constructive unionism, this idea that the British used back in like the 1880s to try to convince Irish people that being ruled by the British was a good thing. So they spent like lots of money on trying to make people's lives better. On the podcast, you guys were arguing that at the moment, Britain seems to be doing something very different, basically the opposite, something that your co-host Naomi called destructive unionism. What is meant by that?
So the history of Ireland's relationship with the Union has been this strange kind of dynamic of Westminster ignoring Ireland as much as possible until it blows up into disaster. Like the most spectacular kind of example of this was Boris Johnson just simply barefaced lying to unionists in Northern Ireland, telling them that there would never be a border in the Irish Sea, with a straight face, saying that no Conservative government could ever do this to the UK, nor ever should do this. And then he went about creating and voting for and winning an election on the back of actually doing exactly that. And the DUP are kind of constantly standing up for Conservative versions of unionism. I wouldn't quite say standing up for the Conservative Party, but they're kind of natural allies with the Conservatives in the UK, the Democratic Unionist Party. So to just liberally burn bridges, so to speak, both culturally and politically, culturally with the people of the unionist community in Northern Ireland and politically with the DUP, is kind of fascinating. It's almost as if they just don't care about the union at all.
But I mean, that is the sense that you get from a lot of English people, right? That people just, and this is a really terrible thing, but a lot of English people just don't really care about Northern Ireland. I mean, like one of your tweets caught my eye the other day, which drew attention to the fact that lots of extremely basic explainers have been appearing in the British media over the past couple of weeks, like trying to explain these riots. And it really struck a chord with me, like quite an embarrassing chord, because it reminded me of my own experience as a very young reporter when I was like 22 and someone asked me to write something about Northern Ireland. And I suddenly realized I knew nothing about the history and politics of a part of my own country. Like it felt like a foreign country. And that is obviously completely unacceptable. And I've tried to educate myself since then. But is this actually, from your experience, quite a common phenomenon for Brits to be completely clueless about Northern Ireland?
Yes, in a nutshell, yes. I should also say that, like, most people that you encounter on this issue express themselves in exactly the way that you have. A lot of people are just very embarrassed about this. And a lot of people say exactly what you just said, which is that they're trying to educate themselves about it. And that's the weirdest thing. It's like, you shouldn't have to educate yourself about it, especially when it comes to Northern Ireland. I mean, forget about the Republic, you know, that is a different country, but Northern Ireland is part of the UK. And to have to educate yourself about what is ostensibly your own country is weird. But in England, we found out that it is possible, if not likely, to go through an entire education system, including a university education system, including history degrees, and never, ever touch on Ireland at all, which is weird. I'll say it again, and I'll tell you why it's weird. I mean, you might say, yeah, we never touched on Luxembourg either, who cares, you know? But the history of Ireland is really consequential to the history of the UK. When the Republic of Ireland became independent, that's not that long ago, 1922, that's like almost a third of the UK breaking away and seceding. You know, that dramatically changed what the UK even is today. Like the UK had to change its name in 1922, and people's nationality on their passports changed. Not to mention that a whole population, like similar to the population of Scotland, stopped being UK citizens, you know, in 1922 and created their own country. Like, it's really strange that this wouldn't be mentioned, you know, or dwelt on even a little bit, like in high school curricula. But not to know anything about Northern Ireland is not to realise that an entire part of the UK, of your country, existed in a state of guerrilla warfare until like 20 years ago. Like that an entire section of the UK is still a contested territory with about half the population not identifying as British, or that like entire cities in the UK are ethnically segregated with communities like separated by hundreds of kilometers of defensive walls, like huge big walls, parts of which are higher than the Berlin Wall ever was. Like, this is in the UK. It's pretty mind-blowing that you might learn about, like, the miners' strikes or the Falklands War in high school, you know, but that this isn't considered important, like, that this is considered irrelevant. And, like, it's all the more baffling as well, considering that this conflict in Northern Ireland, it had an impact on England and Scotland too. You know, there were bombs and terrorist attacks in England and Scotland right into the 1990s. If people do know anything about Northern Ireland, all they know about is the IRA. Sometimes they know about Sinn Féin. They'll often say this phrase, which I hear all the time, that Sinn Féin is the political wing of the IRA. And I don't know where they all heard this, but they repeat it a lot. And that's a nice little phrase. But generally, the same people don't know why these organizations exist, who they were fighting against, or like what was going on at all. And there is practically no awareness that there were British terrorist organizations in Northern Ireland too, like the UVF and the UDA, you know, who were also planting bombs and murdering people in the name of the UK, you know, under the British flag. It must be some kind of mind trick to like just make that disappear from the cultural memory and just remember the ones that you want to remember as the bad guys.
Now that Brexit is starting to really have an impact on people's lives in Northern Ireland, there is this like trade border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. It's a real tangible thing that makes us feel like not entirely one country anymore. And that's starting to have like concrete impact on people's lives in terms of things like, you know, shortages of some things in Northern Irish supermarkets. Like, it's real now. It's serious. Do you think the English might start caring a little bit more about what actually happens in Northern Ireland?
I honestly don't believe that the English don't care. I think this is almost kind of an imposed narrative as well. I think there is a feeling that people don't care because they just haven't been told about what's going on. You know, it sounds a little bit like I'm saying, oh, you bloody English, you know, why can't you educate yourselves? That's not the point at all. You know, I think that English people would really engage in this if they had access, just more access to learning about it. This is important not just for Northern Ireland. This is important for the UK. Because not knowing about Northern Ireland is not knowing about the UK. And if you don't understand the history of Northern Ireland, then, you know, that means that there is a significant number of people in England who really can never understand the history of their own country.
I cannot recommend the Irish passport highly enough. If you're interested in the history and politics of Ireland, or even if you don't think you are, you will end up interested because Naomi and Tim do such a great job of making the whole thing feel really like fun and accessible. Go and listen. They have a quite similar vibe to us, actually, but their brains are much bigger.
Funny and true.
What have you been watching this week?
I watched the latest Louis Theroux documentary.
Oh, yeah.
Shooting Joe Exotic. Have you watched it?
No, but I knew when Tiger King was a big thing early on in the pandemic that Louis Theroux had made a documentary about him previously, right? Or had met him or something.
Yeah, exactly. So Louis Theroux made a documentary about him back in 2011. And in this new documentary, Shooting Joe Exotic, he looks back quite thoughtfully, actually, and reflectively on his own failures in that first documentary. It was quite meta. It's like a documentary about a documentary, which was then followed by a more successful documentary, which was this Tiger King, this huge smash hit Netflix documentary. If you haven't heard anything about it, then yeah, I'm really impressed that you've managed to avoid it. I had actually managed to avoid watching Tiger King. You watched it, didn't you?
I really wanted to be part of the whole early pandemic zeitgeist. So yes, I watched it along with everyone else on the internet.
Yeah, and Theroux is, so he's critical of his own documentary from 2011, but he's also very critical of the Netflix documentary and seems to suggest that they, I don't know, have been relatively irresponsible in their handling of the material and that they've muddied the water around some of the story, which there's no doubt an absolutely extraordinary story that led to, spoiler alert, Joe Exotic ending up in jail. And I'm not Louis Theroux's biggest fan always. I find him sometimes a bit affected. I've talked about that before, like with his awkward, needy British shtick thing.
Sounds exactly like your shtick.
Hey, I'm not needy.
Sorry. Not at all.
But I actually think he did really well with this episode and covered the topic in a nice, calm British way with a bit less of the bombastic Netflix showmanship. So yeah, I'd really recommend it if you can find it wherever you are.
Nice, I'll check it out.
What did you enjoy?
I've got a song for you this week. We over here at the Europeans have been slightly obsessed with sea shanties. If you are a TikTok user, you will know that there's been a bit of a craze for sort of maritime-themed, piratey sounding songs from the past. There was that Scottish postman who got really TikTok famous for his shanty renditions. And I think we also retweeted a sea shanty that someone wrote about the Suez Canal thing during that saga.
I love that one.
But did you know that we actually have an in-house sea shanty composer at the Europeans in the form of our lovely jingle writer, Jim, who I've already talked about today. He's having a good week. But he and his writing partner, Kit Buchan, were actually really ahead of the trend in that they have been working, I think for a couple of years now, on an entire musical of sea shanties. It is going to be incredible.
That is amazing. I mean, is he now suddenly inundated with producers who want to make it?
He certainly should be. It's not out yet because they've been busy with other projects, but the musical is called New Frock, and it's about this community of sailors and stowaways from all over Europe and North Africa, which actually taps into the diverse musical influences that created the sea shanty tradition. For those of you who are interested in like nerdy musical history stuff, it's also going to be a really Euro musical in that it's got songs in Spanish and German and French, I think, as well. So it's going to be amazing. And as a teaser for how amazing it's going to be, they have released one of the songs on Spotify already. It's called Jemima, and I have been singing it all week.
Can we hear a bit?
Yes.
And he swapped his wife for a deck swabbing boy, and all of the men who were in his employ were the roughest of devils who sailed on the sea. Jemima! Jemima, pasture aplenty, a penny an acre. Jemima, Jemima, sweeter than all of the rum in Jamaica.
I went down a bit of a rabbit hole this week and found myself watching a sea shanty explainer on YouTube. And actually, full disclosure, it turns out that to qualify as a sea shanty, a song has to meet like certain rhythmic criteria. So it's not actually true to say that New Frock is going to be a musical made up 100% of sea shanties, but it is going to be 100% nautical.
My happy ending this week, weirdly for the second week in a row, comes from the Swiss Army.
Okay.
Who last week announced that they were finally allowing women in their ranks to wear women's underwear.
Well done.
This week, the Swiss Army are celebrating the 18th birthday of one of their pensioners, Brigadier Broccoli, a tabby cat who has been part of the Swiss military since 2004.
I was a bit confused about how an 18-year-old could be a pensioner, but that's really old, isn't it, for a cat?
Yeah, in cat years, it is. Initially, she was just a neighbour of the barracks in Lys, but eventually her owner, who didn't have much time to care for her, realised that she was more at home in the barracks, and Broccoli was made an official army cat and given the title Brigadier.
Brigadier Broccoli.
It's a great name. She gets world-class treatment from the Swiss Army vets when necessary and generally seems to live a pretty good life. She apparently doesn't have an official job description, but various soldiers spoke to a journalist from Swiss Info about her pastoral role, providing comfort and affection for the many soldiers who have often just left home for the first time. And yes, Switzerland is one of the many European countries that still has some form of conscription. Despite the fact that it is officially a neutral country that doesn't intervene in conflicts, only peacekeeping missions. And interestingly, the Swiss public actually voted overwhelmingly back in 2013 by 73% not to abolish conscription, which I find really surprising.
Well, some countries think it sort of helps knit a nation together, don't they? Keeps the youth out of trouble.
Yeah, I guess so. But 73% of them, I guess they've all done it, so they want to make the young'uns do it too.
You must suffer because I did. We would have been both useless in military service, I think.
Oh, yes, we would. We've talked about that before, though.
Probably have.
According to the article I read on Swiss Info, Broccoli receives a military pension, which I just don't understand, really. I mean, does she have a bank account? Does she receive it in cat biscuits? I don't actually believe it. I think it's fake news.
I think they should take Broccoli's pension and spend it on underwear.
Good idea. Anyway, happy birthday, Brigadier Broccoli. And I promise that this is the final time I will mention the Swiss military in my happy ending segment.
If you would like to send us an email with some exclamation points or without exclamation points, maybe actually send us your thoughts on the use of exclamation points in emails, you can do that at hello@europeanspodcast.com. We are also on all of your fave social media platforms, Twitter at Europeans Pod, Instagram at Europeans Podcast, and we're on Facebook under the Europeans Podcast.
Thank you to our team of producers, Katz Laszlo, Priyanka Shankar, and Andre Popovicu.
We are very proud to be members of the Are We Europe family. If you like beautiful European journalism, you should check out their website, areweeurope.com.
That's all we've got time for this week, but we'll be back next week when I think we'll be heading to Warsaw to talk about a palm tree. All will become clear. Have a good week, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.